Development Podcast, a research into practice conversation with teachers and teacher educators about research and practice. In episode 21, we discussed chapter 4 from Tony Rossi and colleagues' 2015 book, Workplace Learning in Physical Education, Emerging Teacher Stories from the Staff Room and Beyond. We'll begin with an around-the-table discussion.
Just to continue on with our conversation over the last couple of weeks about workplace learning, I think Ash captured, again, the chapter really well, and evolution on this part of the career phase and becoming a teacher and becoming a professional, I think is really critical. And I think a few things really stood out to me in this week's blog. And that is, you know, with different environments within your workplace, you know, it elicits different behaviors and interactions based on, you know, who you are as a person, as an educator, more than exactly what you do within the school. And certainly, you know, your microclimate has an impact on that as well. And each workplace environment and school have, you know, different expectations, cultures, roles that induction teachers need to assimilate to on top of their professional teaching responsibilities. And when I reflect on that, I think there's no doubt in my mind that the interactions with your colleagues within your own microclimate have a similar impact as your teaching performance on the perception that you have within the larger environment that you're in. So I think that that's something that made me reflect. And then consequently, there are interactions within the PE office for pre-service teachers and induction level teachers that either uplift or detract from your overall teaching experience. You know, right now in the school district that I'm teaching, it's a very large district, urban New York district. And right now there's the teacher transfer period process. So teachers can apply to transfer from school to school based on, you know, their preferences or needs or environment. And so I was trying to think about why would they want to transfer out of their current school? Is it a culture? Is it a instructional need? What is some of the reasons that teachers transfer? What is the predominant reason? So I would suspect that workplace environment could have an impact on this. And, you know, you learn a lot about yourself as a teacher and moreover as a person during these periods of time by your participation.
How workplace sometimes keeps people in jobs they shouldn't. I don't want to leave this job because I have such good fun in this staff room, and I'll never find such a group of like-minded people. And you know, and maybe that they make a choice not to go on and progress somewhere else or make decisions because of that. Or equally, people leave very quickly because of those spaces. And you know, we all know of teachers who probably spent too long in a school. Possibly even too long in the profession, but you know, I guess if you have an environment that's it's empowering you to continue to do what you've always done, then it becomes those sorts of spaces. And you know, and equally, if you're recruiting the same people again and again, so the same person is coming into that space, even though they're different versions of them, then I guess you know you could have a. I guess you know it's kind of a question, really. You know, there are reasons why people go, and reasons why people stay, and reasons why people succeed. And sorry, I interrupted you, but I just felt it was an interesting kind of point.
Absolutely, no, that's something that I've wondered throughout this process. Is veteran teachers moving from place to place? Are they comfortable where they're at? Why are they uncomfortable? And I think, you know, this workplace learning kind of captures that. And I think beyond that, you know, pre-service teachers, from my own perspective, I didn't get that experience until I was actually in the profession. So that's a conversation for down the road. But those are my opening thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, from a personal perspective, I've kind of talked to this before, but, you know, I worked in a school for a long time. We had two departments. We did very different things. And when one of my colleagues from the the girls' department retired, she said to me, "Okay, you know, I'm really sorry that you had, you know, the experiences you had. You know, had I been your head of department, then it would have been very different." And it would have been. But my response to her was, "Yeah, but I wouldn't have gone on to do the things that I've done." So in adversity almost, or in difficulty, then I did a master's and a PhD, and I completely transformed the way that I taught. And had I been working with a different colleague or in a different department, then I would never have done that. So, you know, that adversity, you know, was a really, in that case, was good. We talked about this last time, Clancy, so I'll turn it over to you. With that, you know, every learning experience is a good learning experience. And I think in that case, it probably was, because I had to, you know, be proactive. But I wonder how many people either get the experience that fits them like a glove and they never challenge the way that they teach, or equally get the experience that fits their hand like a shoe, and therefore they want to get out typing. That's a really bad analogy, but anyway, I guess you know what I mean.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I felt that the chapter by Rossi and his colleagues was the most interesting of the chapters thus far. And Michael's spot on. I think Ash covered in the blog quite well the main tenets of the chapter. So I'm going to start with a quote from the chapter that I think really, again, connects. And this, is from Rossi. "However, teachers, whether under practicum-type situations or being inducted into the profession, also have to show how they value and ascribe great worth to the learning experiences within the subject department office. Indeed, they often feel compelled to support this, even if it's a misrepresentation." And I think that speaks to what we've been chatting about over the last several weeks and what Ash just mentioned. And, you know, I was, again, I felt that this chapter really centered on some important themes. I really enjoyed the discussion about the theatricality and this idea of front or mask, that perhaps teacher candidates have to put on a mask to assimilate into the workplace, whether they agree or they disagree.
Yeah, well, and then the
micropolitics discussion too. Go ahead, Ash. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, they use Goffman's notion of presentation of self. So how do you present yourself in different situations? So, you know, and that's really important. And you know, and sometimes when we're in, you know, it's that question, you know, when you go to dinner, but your in-laws, well, it changes. My wife and I have been married for a long time. So, but when you first go around, you're on your very best behavior. You know, you're on your Sunday best behavior, and you're very, very polite, and you're not, you know, and then as that relationship changes, so does the way that you work. And I guess that's the same in the PE department. And I guess the question is who am I going to be today? Kind of question, or who am I going to be in this school? And, you know, there are challenges in those spaces as well. I mean, you know, using that quote, I remember on my teacher training, I'd been working unqualified for 2 years. In hindsight, probably thought that, I knew more than I did before I did my teacher training, but also that when somebody genuinely asked me a question about how well they were teaching, that they actually would expect an honest response. What a fool I was. So there was a situation early in my teacher training where I was watching the second in department teach a football lesson, about 30 kids in the group. I think he got out two balls and had the kids stood in, I still remember it, had the kids stood in very long queues with a single ball, and they were dribbling up through cones and dribbling back down again. And it was, you know, kids were stood around, they were bored, it was you know, it wasn't a particularly good lesson. He said to me after the lesson, so what do you think? You know, how did that go? And I went, well, you had a bag of, 20 balls and you only used two. So it would be nice if you could have done the same drill with, smaller cues and whatever. Well, he kind of took it on board and went away. And next thing I know, I was dragged up in front of the, the head of teacher training in the school and basically told that my attitude was really poor, that I was arrogant enough to tell a senior member of staff, how to teach and that I wasn't, producing the goods myself. And, I then was told that I was going to be observed on the next day by this individual and that would decide whether I stayed on the teaching practice or not.
When was this in your career? Was this as a teacher educator or prior?
This was a trainee. This was training to teach myself. So it was 1995.
Wow.
And it was a catalyst where I went on and for the first time did a whole lesson, which I'd never done before. I did a load of research and I guess in some cases it was a really good thing. And it kind of helped me see that there are other ways of teaching, but as a teacher candidate, I guess it was really hard to suddenly be. And I tell my, the students I work with now, if you get asked that question, you have to play the game. You have to tell them, how wonderful you thought the lesson was, and how one day you aspire to be as good a teacher as they were. And that is what I should have said.
Exactly.
But it was a lie. But because the lesson was rubbish. But that's what I should have said. I mean, in hindsight, I was arrogant and I did know everything and I guess that's the bravado of youth really and everything else. But it was a really difficult thing. Obviously I qualified because I went on to have a career in teaching and now I'm here. But and I wonder how many of these little incidences or stuff that other trainee teachers are experiencing because then they're not savvy enough and they're not playing the game. And it shouldn't be about that.
I agree, Ash. And I think, again, that's this chapter was, for me, fascinating. And I think it speaks to what you just referenced, your example juxtaposed to another trainee that might play the game a little bit better as you fashioned. This is that micro political literacy that the author refers to, right? That idea of how to play the game. And here's what I read between the lines from the chapter and your blog that, again, perhaps it's, the aerial view that I've been thinking over the last several weeks is the idea that the experience itself is perhaps a misrepresentation, but the teacher candidate, the induction teacher, whomever, has to play the game. And by playing the game, they start to have their views shaped, whether they implicitly or explicitly want them to be. And so much so that by the end, or as they go further on their careers, they defer to the misrepresentation as opposed to standing on their own 2 feet and perhaps going in a different direction like they may feel when they first start the profession by playing the game. So I think there's a lot going on there.
Yeah, I mean, I was reading, I don't know if you ever read any, John Rebus. Can't remember. It's a detective in Scotland. I've read so many books, I can't. Brain's gone completely dead in terms of who the author is. Hopefully, it will come to me. But they were in a recent book. There was an undercover cop who basically had spent so long undercover, he'd become part of the criminal fraternity. Ian Rankin. There we go. I knew I'd get it eventually. And it's that sort of thing. Is it? The longer you play the role of compliance, the easier is it to become your own kind of mindset in that way. But I mean, it's a question to both of you, Michael in particular, I guess, given that you're the practicing teacher here amongst us. But one of the responses I got was from an international teacher who basically said, this is a really good, really interesting in a blog. We're currently redesigning our office and this is a really good opportunity to think about that. And I kind of wonder how many how many times have you ever consciously thought about the geography? And this goes back to the work that, you know, that Brian Cope was talking about in a very different way, and the work that Mo was talking about and James Rudd were talking about when they came on and talked about the geographies of the school. And I just wonder how often we've even thought about the architecture or the geography of the PE office or the staff room, and how, you know, a reconfiguration of that or a change of that would change the dynamic in the room, or could change the dynamic in the room. And personally, the staff room that I worked in for, you know, many years barely changed its geography. And I just wonder whether that's something that we even think about consciously.
Yeah. You know, I'm going to go back before I get to your question, Ash, because I think you brought up a really interesting point about, you know, induction teachers and their compliance and cooperating teachers and mentor teachers gaining more power in the profession to make the influence. And it goes back to what an author in the United States here, one of my favorite authors who writes a lot of sports fables and stuff like that, called John Gordon. He said, you know, it's the curse of experience. And sometimes the curse of experience within the profession, you know, gives us, you know, teachers that are induction teachers or pre-service teachers a poor experience. And, you know, they, you know, I, as a pre-service teacher, didn't feel the bureaucracy and the power struggle that can occur in these professional trenches until you actually get in there. And, you know, so that was an interesting point. As far as the geography is concerned, I've never thought about it until I read your blog, and I've thought about it in a sporting context with setting up a geography of the locker room. So when schools and colleges and even professional teams are redesigning their locker room and the geography of those spaces, they're now designing them so every player can see each other in that locker room, so a more communal space. You know, you'll probably laugh at me, but I'm a big Arsenal fan in the Premier League, so you know, that could be taken in a few different ways. But but when they built the Emirates Stadium, they completely redesigned the geography of the locker room from two rows of lockers where, you know, if you were sitting in the corner of the room, you weren't able to see. And when I went to London to take a tour of the Emirates, you know, redesigning the geography of the locker room so it was a semicircle so all the players could see each other and have more of a communal conversation at halftime or post game or pre-match. So definitely interesting that I think that can transfer to the PE office as well to make better conversations and set up the geography for more significant workplace learning environment.
Yeah, I think it's a great question by Ash. And I think you could see that working well with bigger departments. You know, in phys ed, oftentimes, you know, thinking about geography, we're often on our own island. You know, we're perhaps a smaller staff. You know, so ideally, you know, if you think about it from a utopian perspective, putting that induction teacher with a really good, you know, cagey veteran teacher that has the right values from physical education in place, you know, nearby, or that would be great. But I just don't know how realistic that would be, at least for PE programs that I see in this part of the world, you know. And then, you know, do you go one step further and do you think about breaking down departments and trying to set up interdisciplinary offices? But I think, you know, just from a access and convenience standpoint, every moment of time in the school day is so valuable. And I think you have to place, you know, teachers near and proximal to their teaching location. So I don't know. I think it's an interesting question. I just don't know how realistic it can be.
Yeah, but if you don't think about it, it's not really, it's not even a comment or a concern to be had. You know, I wonder, was it, so take it going back to the kind of sporting analogy that, I don't know if you're aware, in rugby circles, there's a team called the British and Irish Lions. And this is a team that gets together every four years and is made up of the best players in Scotland, Ireland, Wales and England. They've recently announced a 37-man touring squad to go to South Africa, and they go to South Africa 4 years later, Australia 4 years later, New Zealand, and that's the kind of cycle that they go through. And it's only the men's team that do it. There is talk about finally having a women's Lions, which I think will be, you know, fantastic in itself. But you know, there's a tradition there where the youngest, there is a lion that goes with them, and it sits on the touchline at halfway, and it faces towards the opposition's goal line because it wants to see, you know, all the tries being scored over the opposition's try line, not the ones, you know. And it's a tradition, and you see it, you know, all the time. The lion's kind of this big, you know, two armfuls worth of soft, cuddly toy. And the youngest player has to carry the lion. That's his. That the youngest player on tour. He has to do. He has to do that. And then I was thinking, well, I wonder where the youngest member or newest member of the department has to sit in the staff room. You know, we come back to these geographies. You know, you have the corner seat, or you have the one nearing the drafty door, or, you know, and you know, it can imagine, you know, people leaving and certain people to take it over, you know, prestige, you know, the best chair or those sorts of things. And we're being a little bit flippant, but those are the things that create those environments. You know, those are the ways that, you know, people are treated, you know, in terms of not even age or superior, you know, not some of it's about longitude of service. I mean, we used to have a procession at my old school, and it was the oldest member of staff, as in the person who'd been on the staff for the longest, went to the front, was at the front of the queue, and the new staff were right at the back of the queue. So when you proceeded into, you know, prize giving, then that's the way it was. But the advantage was, if you're at the front, you got the back seats, so you were furthest away from the audience and therefore could do a crossword while you were listening to what was happening. But if you were in the front, you had to be, if you were new, and you had to be, you know, attentive to what was happening, because you were, you know, kind of in the front seats. And I had a colleague who was at the school, left for 2 years of maternity, and then came back. And she had to start again at the back of the front, even though of all the staff she'd been in the school for nearly the longest, she ended up being, you know, right at the back of the queue. And I kind of wonder, how, you know, if that happens in this. So, you know, you get that sense of seniority in the staff room, I guess.
Yeah, it's certainly interesting, Ash, because being a relatively, you know, I've been teaching for 5 or 6 years, but, you know, with the first year in my, you know, teaching at this particular school district, it's been not that experience that you described at all. You know, it's been really welcoming, and the teachers that have been there, veteran teachers, have kind of welcomed me into their office and environment, and it's certainly taken some time to, you know, break down the social barriers that come with being a new staff member within a particular workplace. But I think you know, you have to take the role head on and be really proactive and go out of your way to create those social settings and social interactions that can benefit you personally and career-wise as well. But I think the larger, you know, question that I had from a teacher education standpoint is that we know that KG veterans in the field play a strong role in helping facilitate workplace learning for pre-service and induction teachers. But I know teacher education has a lot to do with, you know, preparing the methodology for pre-service teachers to go into the field and succeed. But how can teacher education in and of itself prepare pre-service teachers to become closer to reality, to experience workplace learning? Or does the workplace itself just have to flesh itself out and have a trial by fire period to include the conditions for the candidate to succeed with the education that they've already garnered? So something that I've wondered about with teacher education.
It's a great question, Michael. And again, I'm, kudos to Ash for bringing this book up for the last several weeks, because it's made me really reflect. And I think that's the million-dollar question for teacher ed, is how do we navigate this? Obviously the practicum, student teaching, clinical experience, it's critical in our training. But so I'm not suggesting that we have to turn it upside down. But I do think we have to be more aware. And from what I'm, what I've garnered thus far, and I, maybe the initial steps are to perhaps explain some of these tensions that take place in the workplace to our teacher candidates in their training, in their coursework, so that they're aware that this takes place, make them, make them privy to it, so they understand that they should expect it, and give them suggestions and recommendations of how to navigate, perhaps, as Ash pointed out, teaching them how to be micro politically linguistic or literate or playing the game. I guess that would be my first reaction.
Yeah, I mean, and I guess there is, there are conversations that happen in all sorts of environments about, the norms that you would expect to experience. We've had conversations before about race, and when you read and listen to conversations about race, then black parents are worrying for their children because they expect them to be treated in certain ways, but then they're not sort of mute about things. They're then trying to advocate for equality and equity, within their own lives, and therefore the lives of their children. And we have a responsibility as teacher educators to do the same. We can prepare them for the types of experiences that they might get, but we must be advocates of change, and we must be, proponents of making things better, I guess. There needs to be a situation where we are having the hard conversations with schools when the reports come back, and explaining to them that in some cases the actions are not right, and equally they need to be having conversations with us to say and they're not easy conversations in either direction, but we have to have those difficult conversations, and as conversations go, they pale into insignificance against other ones, but these are things that I think we need to be more aware of and more prepared to talk about.
Yeah, a lot to consider, Ash. And like I said, I think the last 2 weeks have been eye-opening from a standpoint of workplace learning in the profession, and how, reflecting about the process that I went through, as a teacher candidate and now a practicing teacher, and now my role as giving back to the profession and providing a quality workplace environment, and trying to have those conversations in order to make the necessary adjustments to move the profession forward, and a lot to consider, and a really good deep dive into the chapters and the blogs. And I think Rossing candidates and colleagues certainly have reflected on it as well. So, great conversation.
Yeah, mate. The next blog is written and is up. It's currently called Laugh Yourself Silly, and it's I think it's we now are beginning to get into the the data results chapters of the book and some really interesting, you know, things. And I think as we engage this going forwards, it's, you know, I think it gets even more interesting and more real. And it'll be interesting to hear people's thoughts about that in a week or so. And that's where our discussions ended. I'd like to thank my regular guests, Michael and Clancy, for their company and thoughts. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, and hopefully you'll choose to catch up with us next time when we continue to explore Rossi and colleagues' book.